two destinies. Thetis said, you can choose. Stay in the fight and be known forever as the greatest warrior on earth. And your life will be short as the beat of that wing. Or, if you can be happy without this name, live long and peacefully, farming Peleus' land in Pythia alongside Neoptolemus, the sun now growing in Deidamia's womb. Stay, and you will never meet him while you live. Choose. Deidamia's slender boy lover has grown into a man, his large body molded by action, on action, on action. For 9 years he has followed the flame, not pausing to remember his mother's words. He leads his myrmidons, the ant men, into battle, their shields scrumming to make flexible, impenetrable walls. He makes raids, alone or with Patroclus, cattle massing like storm to thunder down the slope as you close in. Then, reaction. Agamemnon pulls rank, the only way he pulls anything, and takes Briseis, the girl who was Achilles' prize. And Achilles remembers that he can choose. He lays off his men and folds his arms. The 50 beached orange ships frame a village of soldiers at ease. The myrmidons, those strong Machi fighters, are at play. They throw dice, wrestle, fish, tell stories. Patroclus and Achilles dance. The sight of this little village with its smoke and easy laughter offends Agamemnon more than he can say. He feels his army sinking deeper with each day that passes. He feels that they, not Troy, are under siege. The Trojans feel so safe, they come down to the beach and kill Greeks there. And Thetis purrs, satisfied that Zeus is avenging her son. Agamemnon thinks of everything he can to win Achilles back. He will give him the woman now, swearing he hasn't touched her, along with 7 more, and any one of his surviving daughters for a wife when they get home, plus the usual bronze, gold, tripods, etc. Do they really think he's greedy? The only child of Agamemnon he'd marry is the dead one, the one they offered, then killed. He is ready to sail home to a long and nameless future. It's not as if the wounded pride of a son of Atreus was ever his affair. But Patroclus is tender-hearted. It hurts him to see the wounds of his fellows. He begs Achilles, let me go into battle dressed in your armor. And Achilles lets him. This armor fits 3 men and no one else. Achilles, for whom it was made. Patroclus, who nevertheless cannot lift the great ash spear that goes with it. And who else? To a Trojan, it's a fearful sight, Achilles' armor moving again, though without the great ash spear. But Hector, he is the third, is not afraid. He is only disappointed when he comes to peel the armor from Patroclus' body, that the smashed flesh inside is not Achilles. Hector. Before there was the name, there was the shadow. The shadow Achilles felt first at Scyros. It teased his own body onto growth, cell by cell, calling him. Body for body, each grew. so that Achilles' armor, stripped from Patroclus, now fits Hector perfectly. And Achilles no longer has a choice. Ajax and Menelaus have rescued the poor, heavy, mangled body. They thought it would break as they heaved Patroclus by the armpits, while Hector hung on to a foot. Achilles washes the dear flesh, tells Patroclus he will not sleep till Hector is dead, nor will he eat. Achilles of the loud war cry lets out his war cry, and the Achaeans regroup, every man of them merry and agile for war. The Trojans shit themselves. But not even he can go naked into battle and count on winning. Thetis, heavy-hearted, makes him wait, goes to Olympus to order new armor. When he straps it on, he feels himself lifted on wings. When the sun strikes it, men are blinded. The metal is stamped with the future he won't see. On this day, he finds 12 Trojans for Patroclus's funeral pyre. He picks them off easily before sun has cleared the mist. His myrmidons rope them together and drag them off alive. They'll keep. He moves on towards the river. No Trojan has a chance. He on his own has the strength of one army. The myrmidons, all their unused power unleashed, are another. Up to his thighs now in the river Scamander. The river Scamander, choking with blood and corpses, a thick, stinking soup, so full of bodies of men and horse, bits of limbs and pikes, mashed hide of shields it can hardly move. Scamander longs for the sea. So near he could smell it if it weren't for this stinking freight. If only he could flow to join it, this vile cargo would be lifted and dispersed. Then he could breathe again. But now he is so weighed down, so clogged, like a dying man, he cannot raise his head to meet the longed-for water near his mouth. But Scamander will not die. He rouses himself from his deepest fundament, draws up his strength, and heaves again, a terrible dry retching as he throws the bits that choke him out onto his banks, sodden, mangled corpses, men, horses, tackle. And again he can breathe and flow. Now he will drown the man who has hacked so many sons of Troy into his waters. When the river roars at him, Achilles jumps in, ready to take him on. Scamander clasps him, grabs him by the throat, and rises in a tower over his head, like a slab of rock over his head, like his funeral pile heaped over his head. Water, the stuff of his mother, is now so heavy. She never said this would happen, that he would die like a boy whose boat's turned over, his dead flesh waterlogged, teased apart by fish, buried at last in silt and Hector. Alive? Summoning all his strength, he rears, like Atlas rising to slide the heavens from his back. Moving through water, he sees a tree, an elm, its trunk leaning out over the river. He grabs it with one arm and hauls himself up till he has wrapped his legs around. But the weight of Achilles and his heavenly armor is more than the roots of this tree can bear. They try to grip the earth they're dug in, send out new fingers to fasten into the bank. The tree doesn't want to drown either. It clings to the bank, but the bank cannot hold on to itself and breaks away, clod by fat clod, ripping the sinews of root and fiber that bound it. It falls away like cake, a new island carried by the rushing river, Achilles still straddling the tree. Achilles hurls himself towards the open wound of the bank, and the river Scamander gathers itself up into a wall so high it blots out the sun. This wall of water comes after Achilles. Zeus! Help me! The prayer hits target. Though Achilles is not his son, because Achilles is not his son, Zeus loves him. He sends his brother Poseidon and his grey-eyed brainchild Athene to clasp the man's hands and bear him up. They assure him he will kill Hector. Nothing can take this from him. But Scamander won't let up. His wall of water's poised to crash down, even on the gods. Zeus and Athene call on Hephaestus, ask him for fire. Hephaestus lobs fire down, and for a moment that all who survived will remember forever, a river of molten flame pours through the sky. As it meets land, it roars into a blaze, romping over the heaped bodies that Achilles killed that morning, eating them whole. Hungry still, it makes for the river, breathes on the water, which shrinks, scalded from the banks. Scamander, a hot, narrow vein in a bed of baking mud, surrenders. The Trojan soldiers, what's left of them, are scuttling back behind the walls. How small they look in flight, men who even yesterday shone with power as they poured across the beach. The women watching from the ramparts see the small wounded dots hauling their way up the hill. Husband, brother, child. Something in the configuration of each moving mark is unmistakable to eyes made sharp by love. Hephaestus's flames have eaten the dead, but the wounded are brought home on stretchers of shields or dragged, slumped across their companion's shoulders. The dust on the paths is rosy with blood. Men tumble through the gate, men without arms, men with barely half a face, a hole where the nose was. One unstraps his helmet, and as he tugs it off, the skull flaps back, and his brains slide down his neck. Quick. Close the gate. Achilles is coming. Those who have only heard of Achilles would like to linger for a glimpse, but the men who press in push them back. They bundle their companions through, if only to die inside Troy's walls. Priam orders them to close the great Scaean gate before Achilles can reach it. Quick, get in! The huge leaves of the gate are pushed together, the enormous bolts heaved into place. For a moment they breathe in relief. But they know the end has begun. Then someone says that Hector is still out there. The two of them out there. They needn't have bothered to run. Achilles has no interest in any other Trojan now. He has just seen Hector from the plain, high on a boulder near the ramparts, in full view, surveying the land below, as if spears, boulders, and axes could not be hurled, as if he were watching the sky for signs of weather. Achilles reaches the wall and sees Hector outside the gates, and easy spears flight away. They look at each other, and just for a moment, time stops. Eyes blazing into eyes as each takes in the form and splendor of the other and thinks, it's him. Then Achilles raises the great ash spear, and Hector begins to run, and the race, which both always knew would one day begin, begins. Hector's feet are sure, they know these tracks, where they'll find scree, where the ground is firm. As he runs, he remembers each part of his life, the bushes and rocks of his boyhood hideouts, the promontory he lay on one full night to learn the stars, the roots of his hunting, his cattle herding, the waterfall he led Andromache to when he wooed her. He remembers his life spread out before him like a giant sheet in the sun, the way ahead, narrowing to a tunnel which he runs down. The rhythm of their steps goes on forever. It makes no difference that Achilles does not know the terrain so well. He is strong as a stag, inexhaustible. Hector can gain no ground. Three times they circle the city. Now Hector scans the walls for armed comrades who might occupy Achilles while he scales the battlements and escapes. But Achilles never lets him get close to the walls. The Myrmidons press in. Stationed at various points in the circuit, they follow Achilles as they can, keeping Hector running, blocking off his escapes. But if one of them raises a spear or a boulder, Achilles glares him to a halt. No one will take this kill from him. Athene is with him again, not at all out of breath. She tells him again that Hector is his. She promises to make him stop. Then, looking like Dea Phoebus, she catches up with Hector, who takes heart, happy that his dear brother has risked life to join him. Ready now, he stops in his tracks and turns. Again, Achilles' eyes meet Hector's. The Myrmidons stand back. Hector proposes an honourable deal. The winner will treat the other's body with respect and allow his people to fetch it for a decent burial. Achilles looks at the man who killed Patroclus and feels the hatred spread through his body, slowly, luxuriously, like cream. A sumptuous hatred that leaves no part of him unfilled. No, Hector. He lifts the great ash spear that even Patroclus could not hold and throws. Hector ducks. The spear pierces the ground. Immediately, unseen by Hector, Athene tweaks it out and hands it back to Achilles. Now it is Hector's throw. Achilles' miss has cheered him. He casts his own great spear, which lands dead center in Achilles' Olympic shield. But no god tweaks it out, and he has no other spear. Dei Phoebus is nowhere to be seen. Now he knows he has come to his death. He draws his huge sword and wields it in both hands. Achilles takes his sword too, after the day's slaughter the divine blade still flashes like a sun. There is all the time he could ever want. He looks Hector over, scanning the armor that fits him so well, searching for a place to insert his blade. Like a lover taking in every inch of his beloved as they lie in the hot sun. All the time he could want. No rush. No fear of missing. There. The one point where the armor does not close over Hector, the tender diamond hollow between the clavicles, is naked. Achilles fits his sword's tip here. Slowly, evenly, the pressure mounting, he pushes. Only two of the three chariot horses remain. Pedasus has fallen, the outrigger who gallantly kept pace. Only the two immortals are left. This is the 12th dawn, broken by Achilles, heaving them into harness. Each dawn, for the last 11 days, he has hooked great Hector's body like a plough to the tail of his chariot. He has threaded a strap through Hector's ankles, thonging them together like fish to be carried. Then he hooks this thong to his car and drags the body, nose bumping down, through the dust. Three times each morning he has circled the stone barrow they have built for Patroclus, a modest barrow meant to tide Patroclus over till the not far time when he and Achilles will lie together again. Achilles has not slept since his oblivion on the beach after the funeral. Then he was out, face down in the sand by the raked over ashes. Patroclus had let him rest, but not for long. For the last 11 days and nights, his eyes have burned in their sockets. Those eyes make his men afraid, but he doesn't see them. He doesn't notice Briseis, more friendless than ever with Patroclus gone. He doesn't even see the barrow where Patroclus' ashes lie, though round and round and round he goes. He has eyes for one man only, that huge body, winched up by the heels each day at dawn, which will not rot, which will not stop being beautiful. When he had done killing Hector, the Myrmidons had each had a go, killing him again and again. They took it in turns to shove in a spear. Some jabbed, others wiggled, getting a feel of the man, till Hector's body, stripped of the armor he had stolen from Patroclus, was squelching pulp. Now those wounds are sealed. Achilles has never seen a body so perfect. It has only one mark, a stain like a kiss at Hector's throat. On this 12th morning, he is making for Hector when Thetis appears. She interposes her immortal self between Hector and her son, and Achilles, wanting to see round her, is forced to see her. She takes a hand in both her cool ones, holds his head and kisses his hammering brow. Child, this has to stop. At the same moment, Iris goes to Priam. His eyes are raw with weeping and tears have made stripes in the filth on his face. The goddess touches his shoulder. Priam, this cannot go on. Zeus has sent me to tell you, you are to go to Achilles with gifts, and he in return will give you Hector's body. Take your chariot, a wagon for a bier, and one driver. You won't need a guard. Hecuba thinks her husband has gone mad. His plan is certain death. The end of Troy, sure enough with Hector gone, a matter now of days. If you're so sure Zeus is with you, ask him for a sign. Priam is sure. Outside with his wagon and his old herald Idaeus to drive it, he offers Zeus wine and prays to the thinker god to send his bird. They hear the heavy wings of Zeus's eagle and see the bird riding the air to the right. Falling under its huge shadow, Hecuba's heart clears. All day, Achilles has sat with Hector, watching him, not taking his eyes off him for a second. He doesn't move, only a muscle in his cheek tightens from time to time. Cassandra looks down through the dusk from the ramparts of Troy and watches her father set off in the mule-drawn wagon with the cart behind it. The great eagle stays close to the travellers, holding the wagon as tight in its gaze as a gull holds a boat soon to land its trawl. Zeus sends Hermes to guide them in the form of a myrmidon. Priam and Idaeus have stopped to water the animals. It is a warm dusk and the mist rises high from Scamander's banks. When they see the myrmidon shoulder through the mist towards them, Priam's hand moves towards his sword. The royal Priam, away from Troy so late? Have you deserted her now there's no Hector? Priam flinches. The god goes on. You'll know me for one of Achilles' men. Don't be afraid, I've a father your age. But what are you doing here with this old man? Do you want to get killed? Priam is not afraid. When Hermes tells him that Hector's body is as firm and as beautiful as if gods had embalmed it, his heart soars. Hector's piety has not gone unnoticed. He rummages for a moment beneath the wagon's wicker cover, comes up with a heavy golden beaker. Hermes refuses the gift, pretending to think it a bribe. But I will guide you past the sentries and take you to the Lord Achilles. These nights he never sleeps. It is Hermes who puts the sentries to sleep. Idaeus' wagon with four mules drawing it, Priam's chariot with Hermes riding it, move as peacefully across the Achaean trench as two farm carts entering town on market day. When they reach Achilles' compound, fenced off, his ship moored nearby, Hermes reveals himself to Priam. Only a god, or Achilles, could single-handed slip back the bolt that fastens that fence. Achilles sits motionless, a table of untasted food in front of him. Priam sinks before him and embraces his knees. Imagine the mighty Priam crouched before you like a child. Gently, Achilles removes his hands from the old man's clasp. For a moment it looks as if he will stroke the long white hair. It is so like the hair of his own father, whom he has not seen these 9 years since he sailed with Phoenix for Troy. Huge sobs break from Achilles as he thinks of Peleus, aging at home, uncomforted by his son. And Priam? He thinks of Hector. Of what else has he thought these 12 days? Who was like no one else on earth, and whom no one could match, but this man. The two men hold each other and weep for those they have lost, for those who will lose them, and for all the men gone down in the slow years of this wasteful war. When the time for tears is past, Achilles raises Priam to his feet and fetches him a fine inlaid chair. You're brave to come here unguarded. My men are like wolves. I kept them out of the fight too long. Now they've tasted blood again. It's Hector's body I come for. There was no question of fear. This irritates Achilles. Don't give me that. It takes three young, strong men to knock back the bolt on my gate. I know you've been helped by a god. I've had my instructions too. My mother told me I must give you the body. It's Zeus's wish, and that's why you'll get it. Not anything you do or say. He turns away, the muscle in his cheek at work again. He has someone fetch Idaeus and unload the gifts while he leaves Priam and takes two of his women to where he keeps Hector's body when he's not dragging him in the dust. He glares at Hector accusingly, as if a pact has been broken, then snaps into command, telling the women to wash the body and be sure to rinse away every grain of dirt. When the body is clean, the women are to anoint it. Priam must be kept from seeing the body till it is time to take it with him. If he sees the body now, he will want to kill Achilles. Achilles knows how strong old men can be, but it is his own strength he fears. If Priam's hands go for his throat, he can buck him off. The hard thing is stopping there. He sees Priam crashing to the floor and the outrage in his eyes. He feels his own shame. Mother, cool me down. And he feels Thetis's sea-cool hand pass over him. He goes back and examines Priam's gifts, noting their splendor with satisfaction. He picks out one of the softest robes and goes. Priam half rises to follow, stops when he meets Achilles' gaze. The women have oiled Hector and laid him out. The power that shines from him is blinding. Achilles hands the garment to the women, hoping it will veil the brightness which tells him the gods love Hector, even in death. He supports the great shoulders as Automedon and Alcimus help him carry Hector to the wagon. He looks on his conquered enemy for the last time. Priam wants to rush out to the bier, but Achilles restrains him. "There is a time for everything," he says. "Whatever the occasion, a man needs food and rest." This from Achilles. Even Niobe needed to eat at last, though for 10 days after her children's slaughter, she neither ate nor slept. "Tonight you're my guest. You must eat, and I must serve you." He goes outside to his small flock, their meat and milk for his household use, and takes the finest and whitest wool and slaughters it. He slings the carcass over his neck and carries it into the hut, where he works quickly and neatly, cutting the flesh from mantling fat. Then he and his men thread the meat onto spits, which they thrust into the fire to sizzle and drop their juices. Baskets of bread are passed around and each man helps himself, Achilles helping Priam to the best until he can take no more. Wine is drunk, the best of Achilles' store, most delicious to Achilles and Priam who have fasted and watched these 12 days. Filled with the comfort of food and wine, Priam is at peace. The grief and hatred that have been driving him step down. The pain slides off and his limbs relax and warm to being at rest. He looks at his host and finds him magnificent. He admires, though cannot like, Achilles' nerved face, each feature outlined clear, the huge hands that can fashion as well as place a spear. Achilles too is soothed. The fury that has gripped him, worried at him, gnawed him, thwacked him against her cavern's walls has put him down. He looks at his guest and admires the breadth of the man, the stature that age has not shrunk up. He senses what real power those scepter-wielding hands still hold. But Priam is tired and craves a bed. Achilles' guard is up again. "You mustn't be seen here. You and your herald must sleep outside. But first, how many days will you need to prepare for Hector's funeral? I will lay off the troops for as long as you need." Priam asks for 11 days so the Trojans can go safely into the mountains to gather wood for the pyre. Achilles grasps Priam's wrist as a pledge of his faith, and the two men part to sleep. The stars stick out like jewels. Priam's sleep is deep and dreamless in the high bed prepared by Achilles' women. He is woken by Hermes. "Priam, Priam, get up. How can you sleep with your enemies all around? Hurry now. We must go while it's still dark." Priam and Idaeus scramble down from their beds. Quietly, they untether the horses and harness them to the chariot. The horses are restive and eager to go. Their snorts and pacings break the quiet. But the night is always full of sounds, the sheep bells clanking and the wind in the rigging of the great Achaean fleet. They yoke the mules to the bier and Idaeus climbs up to drive them while Priam takes his horse's reins. Hermes speeds ahead, slips back the bolt, then climbs up next to Priam. The horses prick back their ears when the Olympian takes the reins. This night, like every night, fires light the plain, and from afar it looks another sky, mirroring the clearer heavenly one with its more muddied light. As they pass the trench and begin to cross the plain, the firelight bruises the air with reddish smoke. They thread between the fires, feeling the heat from each in turn like a pulse. As they pass, Hermes puts each vigilant sentry to sleep. But Cassandra stays vigilant. She has watched ever since her father set off, saw him and Adeus wind their way across the scrubby plain, and now, though she doesn't see Hermes slide down from his seat and head off, she's the first to see the laden bier return. She runs down from the battlements and cries, "Hector has come home!" And Achilles wakes from his sleep, face down, one arm slung over Briseis's back. Listen, Achilles never wanted to die. Don't think because Patroclus is dead he wants to die. His hair has grown again, the thick auburn lock he cut and laid on Patroclus's corpse, but that hank of hair which went down with his friend is a forerunner, part of him hostage in the underworld. What does he love now? Enough to hold him here. He loves the light, twice as much as before. At times he seems almost merry. The Achaeans feel themselves renewed. They are fighting with the strength they had at first, before the 10 years wore them down. Achilles now is more mortal than ever. Knowing it, he fights like a god. And Zeus is as proud of him as if he'd seeded him. He and Patroclus once said they would bring down Troy alone, Troy and all her allies. Now, as he fights, he is like a fire in summer. He has heard stories about the women fighters. Some say they have seen them like furies, they say, like she-wolves. A pack will stalk, round up, and set upon a victim, each taking part in the kill, each, so they say, tasting the flesh of their prey and smearing herself with his blood. What is it makes him know it's a woman he sees, that mounted figure looking out over the plain from the cliff? He knows as surely as if he were next to her, breathing the scent of her flesh. And he will meet her. Not on horseback, though she is mounted, and not encased in his heavenly armour. When he goes to find her, he is dressed lightly, as if he were going to a wrestling bout or a diver in search of pearls. He takes only a small dagger tucked into the band he wears at his waist. He does not make for the promontory where he saw her looking out, but a little way inland, where the bushes grow tight and give good cover. She must ride this way, unless her horse can fly. As he waits, he listens. If it is true they hunt in packs, there will be others. This is a quiet place, away from the knots of fighting which form, collapse, and reassemble hour after hour after hour. Here the only sounds are the shifting hum of the bees grazing in thyme and myrtle, the slight breath of wind. Chiron taught him to attend to its shiftings. He can lay his mind open like a bird and ride wide-winged upon the thermals. He hears her horse, twigs snapping, bushes pressed, the quiet tearing of fibres as turf is crushed. Almost silently, he climbs up into a strong tree, a chestnut, and waits. Penthesilea, Queen of the Amazons. She was watching the sea, which today is breaking and breaking in little white waves, each a gash in the sea's body, a wound which heals till the skin breaks open again somewhere else. She has no taste for this war of Priam's, no feel for its arbitrary rhythms. The battles she and her women excel in are concentrated and unremitting to the end. This war lacks definition. The allies don't know each other. There are too many languages. They cannot move as one. This morning she has ridden away from her warriors to rinse her mind clean. Achilles waits till she has passed below, then swings his body forward to land exactly and neatly behind her. He has dropped like this in 100 ambushes, dragging riders, sometimes galloping, to the ground. This one he clasps tight and holds his dagger to her throat, but he does not pull her down. The moment she knows this enemy behind her, she jabs her elbows back into his ribs and would spin round to fight him were it not for the blade tightening at her throat. Defying it, she calls to her horse and drives her heels sharply into the stallion's flanks, so he rears up whinnying, vertical as a pillar. Achilles is not shaken off, and Penthesilea calls out again. In spite of the bushes, in spite of the narrowness and difficulty of the path, they begin to gallop. Careful not to slacken the closeness of knife to throat, but not tightening it either, Achilles presses the Amazon's upper body with his own, down upon the horse's neck, so he lies across her like a shield as they plunge through the thick growth of trees and bushes. They come to open ground, the sun on his back again, and he straightens, drawing her with him. On surer ground, the Amazon's horse gallops more freely, making for the camp where he has grazed, where the mare who foaled him grazes now. Soon they will be visible to the other Amazons. Penthesilea knows they will pick off the man with their arrows. Now, as never before, she must trust their skill. It is his neck they must hit, or his side, but neck is better. The slightest misjudgment could wound her or the horse. Achilles knows he could pull her from the horse at any moment. On this open plain, he could easily break their fall. He stays because there is a pleasure in galloping like this, holding her close. Two breasts, the rumours aren't true, and narrow hips, a waist lean and flexible. He enjoys the smell of her strong sweat, no taint of fear in it. He is hungry to rip the life out of any man or woman who might have wished Hector more alive than Patroclus. But this strong-legged woman did not care for Hector. The Amazons, like most of Troy's allies, can have no more interest in Paris's quarrel with Menelaus than he and Patroclus once had. When he saw her looking out to sea, he thought of Iphigenia. Only this one is hot, where the other, bowed to Artemis, was blade cool. For Penthesilea, too, there is comfort in his belly meeting her back. She is as easy with his movements as she is with her horse, whose limbs are almost her own. But her mind tells her otherwise, tells her to oppose this man and kill him. She must do it herself. Her sisters must not see her powerless like this, a man's arm pinning hers to her body, while his other holds a knife to her throat, holds it so close he could trim her neck like a piece of wood. If she could meet him head on, she could fight him. When she turns her head, he withdraws the knife a fraction, not much, not enough to prevent a fine necklace of blood pricking out around her throat. Riding behind her, pressing up close, has aroused him, and the sight of her face, cheekbones soaring like the wings of swallows, makes him want her more. In turning, she thought to shove him to the ground where she'd fall on him and quickly stab him, but it is he who drags her with him from the horse and grapples her close as they break their fall in the grass. She thrusts a hand into the roots to stay herself, finds a small sharp stone which she rapidly prizes from the ground and palms. Achilles has taken his knife from her throat. He holds her now to steady her, not to restrain her. He looks at her blazing, furious face and laughs, glad that she exists. My queen! The words are nonsense to her, a foreign babble. Though her back still sings with the memory of him pressing her, she will not submit. He draws her to him, puts his tongue to the wound in her throat, iron of blood mixed with salt of sweat. His tongue will scour it clean. Ah! A sharp, dangerous pain flames up his spine. He twists to throw off whatever it is that attacks him, pushes her hands away with a force that might snap her forearms, sees the bloody little nose of flint she's been using to excavate the base of his spine. Now he pins her down, all his hurt, unmet tenderness turned to indignation. He bends her fingers back to make her release the flint, and she makes those fingers her weapons, tearing his face, stabbing at eyes. His knee bent across her ribs, holding her down, he covers her face with one hand, the heel of the hand hooking neatly under her chin, the other hand cradling the back of her skull. He pushes. He feels her body trying to arch beneath him, the resistance of her head as he struggles to free it. He pushes on, pushes, and then, with practiced economy, twists. He holds her a little longer, waiting for the turmoil of the body to quieten, waiting for it to be over. His hand fits her face perfectly. Its mask. He peels it away with a sense of wonder, as if what lies beneath his palm is something he has made and never seen. Like a potter when he lifts a piece from the cooled furnace. He catches it and lifts the body of his new love across the stallion's back. When he too is on the horse, he holds her body to him. He will take her to the sea, to the place she was gazing at, where the sea is clean, not churning with slaughtered bodies. The difficulty amidst all this slaughter is to hold on to what is distinct. Catch the little gust of a dying breath. Follow the brightness of one face before it is eaten by dark. Sometimes in battle he sees a face, the curve of a cheek, the way the light catches it, and he follows it, makes it his guide to lead him deeper into the mess. So, Polyxena's face, bright as the moon. Always throughout his life, bright faces moving away, disappearing behind curtains. His mother taken back in a curtain of water. Iphigenia wrapped in flames. Patroclus's face as it speaks to him these nights, folded in darkness. When Polyxena's form is swallowed by the curtain of the entrance to the temple, he must go after. Layer on layer are here. Following this girl, he follows them all. His mother, Iphigenia, Penthesilea, Patroclus. Yes, and Hector too. He will pursue them all to the vanishing point, but he must not lose sight of her. She is going into Apollo's temple. She carries a pitcher of clean water and intends to scour and rinse the temple till there is no mote of dust for the god's sunshaft to light upon. Nothing must get in his way. Apollo's light must fill this place till it is tight with power. Paris is in there, taking shelter. At least Apollo loves him and repairs his bruised pride. It is hard to be so hated and despised, even by Helen these days. He likes to think he resembles Apollo, young-ish, lithe, good-looking, fairly good at singing, a crack archer. Forget the healing. The fact is, Apollo has no feelings either way about Paris. Who? Oh, yes, him. Amazing what looks do. But Achilles. Apollo hates Achilles. He has every reason to, for Achilles, not even a god, excels in everything that he, divine Apollo, is good at. Achilles is the best musician, the best archer. He is also, using only mortal means, the best physician, as good at dressing wounds as making them. And Zeus, Apollo's father, loves Achilles as if he were his own. When Achilles plunges in over the threshold, it is simple to take aim. Simple to nudge Paris into doing the gestures. Lift bow. Notch arrow. Release. Simple to bend the flight of Paris's arrow so it no longer goes for the heart, but the left heel, where Achilles' life is strangely gathered and held. Following a face in a crowd, a face bright as the moon, the crowd closes in, darkening the way, getting between him and the face he must find and follow. The face of Thetis, Iphigenia, Penthesilea, Polyxena. The face of Deidamia, of Patroclus, Hector. Stumbling now, for it is dark and he's lost sight of the face in all the throng, he feels an army's worth of arrows rain down on him. His flesh is like a beach when the rain drums down in hard vertical lines, pushing its way through the sand, drenching every grain. These arrows pierce each cell of him, breaking the walls. He is carried on the river of his own blood, mighty as Scamander, storming the channels of his body. He is carried to the place where the river is sucked into a twist, and the other river begins.